Good afternoon. We were talking about anatta yesterday. And we went through the business of how the self-sense arises, the illusory self-sense. Because remember, anatta means that what is here is not me, it's not an atta, it's not self in that peculiar rendering that Suamok used. And remember, it doesn't mean that there's nothing here at all. It's just that what is here is not me. Simple. There's an instinct for survival. But that instinct for survival is dependent on experience also. That is, whenever we experience anything, depending on the experience, the sense of the survival instinct will arise with the experience. Strong or weak, depending on what we're experiencing. If it's a dangerous experience, then our survival sense will be very bright and sharp, as it will have to be. So that too is not any permanent entity, but it seems we are quite capable of turning it into one, if indeed it is the survival instinct which is at the bottom of the problem of the illusion of self, of ego. I think I mentioned the psychology behind the whole process that gives rise to selfishness, including the denial of impermanence, the ignorance of the fact that things do change and transform. And if you have something that doesn't change and transform, or you believe doesn't change and transform all the time, convert the body and mind into me by doing that quite easily, because you have something stable to put the concept self onto, or soul, or spirit, or whichever word we choose to use. And because human beings, like all things, would prefer to be in a happy position than in what we call unhappy, an unhappy position, it tends to be what we seek. I think it's quite natural for things to move towards the pleasant, not unnatural for them to turn the pleasant into the stimulating. But we want to be happy, let's put it that way. And the basis of really happiness, the basis of it is stability. Or some sense of stability, of security. If you don't have that, you're certainly not going to feel very happy. Simple. If you're in a position, for instance, where you have to renew your visa, say, in a foreign country, a country like this, perhaps, and you're not sure that that's going to be granted, you're not going to feel very happy until you know that it is. Or it isn't. The certainty then is will bring some level of quietness into your mind, but until that you'll be thinking and anxious and worrying about it. So to project stability, the meaning of stability, the meaning of Nichan rather than Anichan into our experiences, into ourselves, comes from that source. The desire for happiness, the psychological need for happiness. As does the idea of rebirth, if you give it some thought, a slightly controversial statement, but it has its psychological roots, and it's really fairly obvious when you give it some thought. Especially if you've taken the trouble to get your mind into a condition where it can think clearly. Desire to be happy, well, death is the end of life. Does that make anybody happy, the thought of dying? Of course it doesn't. It terrifies us, normally, till we recognize the truth of it to some extent. And it doesn't. It's not quite so bad. But this perceptual process, the cognitive process, the continual experiencing of things, seeing the world we live in, will be gone. That's a great mystery, death. We don't know what follows it. If anything does, where do we go? We go to some place, according to cosmologies that come with religions, pre-packed with religions, come bundled with the operating systems we call religions. We go to hell, we go to heaven, we go to the Pretaloka, we go to the Asura guy, the demon realm. We might be animals. might even be human again. But one place they never mention is called Nowhere. And then again, that wouldn't do, would it? After death, you go nowhere. Okay, right, it's the end of it. Find somebody else to give food to. You get it. You go nowhere. That's wonderful. I've been waiting all my life to hear that. So it seems to me the psychological need to be happy is behind all these sort of concepts, because basically that's what they are. Until we know different, some people claim to understand or to have the knowledge concerning things like rebirth, for instance. Now they have that knowledge, it's beyond my understanding, but they do have it, so they say. Or so their disciples say. Usually such people are a lot wiser than that. They don't really make such claims. And the Buddha did seem to teach rebirth in the physical sense, from one life to another. But it's always kind of mystified me how anybody could think that. I've read the scriptures, sure, end to end, but I know what the word for birth is, but I've never yet found the word for rebirth in the Buddhist lexicon. It does not exist in the dictionary. The word jati is the word for birth. The Thai word chat comes from it. It has a slightly different meaning in Thai. But that word does not mean rebirth, it means birth. Everybody knows this and everybody acknowledges it. Buddhadasa made this point over and over, but it didn't seem to make much difference. There's no word for rebirth in the Buddhist pantheon. And yet, he's saddled over and over with that he was teaching rebirth. Siddhartha Gautama, this was what he was teaching. That, coming on top of anatta, of course, creates some initial problems, but anatta can be got round. You can skirt it, you can be a little politic, and you can explain rebirth without anything actually being reborn. And some fairly complicated explanations there are too. Of course they would need to be. To explain how you can fit rebirth into the Buddha's teaching when the Buddha's teaching contains the doctrine of anatta. What is here now is not you. There's no permanent entity, no cause or experience. Nothing is going to transmigrate which is going to last in that case. It's not possible. It cannot happen. If I'm not living life now, then I'm not going to be living life after death either. Always been a problem, so a kind of explanation has been put together over the centuries. Going back to a very famous sage, the king asked him questions. The king's name, I think, was Melinda. Questions of King Melinda to the sage. I don't know what his name was, what to call him. Bert Sproggis, I think his name was. It was somebody very famous, but a Buddhist, sometime after the Buddha's death. And this Melinda king, this king person, he asked him certain questions, because this chap was a great sage, he knew everything, he was supposed to be enlightened and all that. And one of the questions, of course, was, you know, what's the truth of rebirth? We hear this, we hear that, so, you know, what is the truth of it? He didn't ask him what the Buddha taught, he just asked him what the truth of it was. And he came out with this explanation. We didn't explain anything. He said, listen, great king, there is rebirth, but nothing gets reborn. And the king was quite happy with that, apparently. And that's as far as it went, so. But wonderful. That's the way to do it. There is rebirth, but nothing gets reborn. So if you can think of yourself, we kind of prepared the way a little bit for this over the few days we've been together. Now we talked about the human being as being, remember the mental side is important. You need to not worry too much about the physical body now, because of death that's going to go anyway. Everybody knows that, and they burn the thing. So that's not going anywhere. You better hope it's not going anywhere, otherwise you'll be inhabiting a pile of ashes in your next life. It's not going to be much fun. So you have to think of yourself as a stream of existence, a stream of conscious events, which is basically what life is. It's not a great mystery, this. It's not something outside of Buddhism. It's more or less what Buddhism teaches. A stream of events, mental events, one giving rise to the next and colouring the next, and so on and so forth, happening right throughout life. Driven by desire. desire for stimulation, desire to exist in this way, desire to not exist in that way, the three forms of craving. Because for an ignorant human being, that's the only desire there really is. And driven also by those root defilements we mentioned, greed, aversion and delusion, continually getting stronger and keeping the human creature always moving in the same direction. So always desiring to become this, become that, to experience some sensual stimulation in some way. This is what recreates the ego sense. The same desire for the same experiences recreates the sense of self in the human mind continually. And, say the rebirth people, more importantly, as far as they're concerned, this is what causes you to get reborn. But it won't be you. It'll be what you think you are. We mentioned the aggregates, the khandhas. These aren't things, remember. They're evanescent processes. Ephemeral in the extreme. They arise, they pass away almost instantaneously. Everything is like this. There's a sense contact. Consciousness arises, but that consciousness is not any stream of consciousness connected. It's independent pulses of energy. People always have a problem with this. But if you think of, there's a game in England, or they used to be, called dominoes. Are you familiar with it? It's little black oblong squares. They have numbers on them. One number on top, another number on the bottom. And the way you play the game is by matching the numbers. You put a domino down, and the next person matches the number. So they go in different directions. But they're kind of thick. They're little pieces of wood, about a quarter of an inch thick, 2 inches high, maybe an inch wide. You can stand them on their ends. And one of the things people do is they make big, big, like, tracks of these dominoes, one in front of the other. They make incredibly complicated patterns. Sometimes they fill a whole room with them, and then lots of enthusiasts are doing this, because people like to do this, you know. They come along and they all sit there, and then the great moment arrives, and the guy knocks the first one over. And everything else then falls over as a response. That domino knocks the next, and the whole lot falls over. Those dominoes aren't connected physically in the normal sense, but they each affect the next one, and consciousness in the Buddhist sense is something like this. So if you can think of yourself in this way as a stream of conscious events, rather like that stream of dominoes, that's basically what your life has been. I don't know how clear that is. I've not heard it before. And you're driven but from one moment of that life, one experience to the next by desire, and that creates these underlying defilements, which then keep you doing the same thing. They create habit patterns that you can't escape easily. The idea is at the end of life that just goes on happening. The body disappears, but the stream of consciousness, remember, it's not a connected thing. It just carries on knocking dominoes over, as it were. One thing carries on leading on to another. It's not like the conscious moments don't cease at death. They just carry on. They just carry on in a different physical form. And in this way, you can get round the problem of anatta, because that is not you, that's just the mind, if you like, or the functions of the mind. Not easy to deal with, I suppose. Never convinced me much. But this stuff never does. Some level of clarity, you tend to look right through it. It's fairly obvious to me where it comes from, but that's only my experience, and it's only my opinion. Not worth a lot, really. Satisfies me until I die and find it's different. And it won't satisfy me. Find myself in hell. You denied it. You denied it. And come on, let me sink this pitchfork into your buttocks and get in that tub of lava. I don't think so. That's just obvious. It's teddy bear stuff. People believe it. People believe rebirth even though they've no experience of it. There are people who claim to have experience, and these experiences are sometimes put forward as being absolute proof that this happens. Some very eminent people believe it. Some very eminent monks, some who are supposed to be enlightened, believe it. I really don't know. It's my opinion that it's not worth anything, but that's just my opinion. We must make our own minds up about this, but it's wise to do some investigation before you do it. The theory of rebirth predates the Buddha, apparently. There's some dispute over this, of course, as there always is in Buddhist circles, also in Hindu circles. Hinduism is much the same. Dates aren't easy to come by. Definite dates hardly exist in Indian history, just a few. I mean, the Buddha's birth and death, for one thing, aren't certain. They always have been thought to be certain, but in recent times, more modern scholarship has put all this in quite a lot of doubt. You know, the Buddha could have been born 100 years later than they think, or even 100 years earlier, in some opinions. It's all very up in the air. You find the first mention of rebirth, apparently, according to my man Arthur Basham, who was a Sanskritist and a professor of that business, spent his life scraping away at the old Vedas and Upanishads and Brahmanyas and all the ancient books of the Hindu theology and the Brahman theology that preceded it, looking for two things, basically. One of them was the origin of the theory of rebirth or reincarnation. Because like all thinking people, he wanted some kind of understanding of just where this started. You know, did it come from the gods? And if it did, we're in trouble. He found it didn't come from the gods at all. It came from a guy called Yajnavalkya. At least, that's what the Upanishads say. The ancient books of the Brahman religion, that which preceded modern Hinduism, are called Vedas. And not what you think. They're pretty dry stuff. One of them is of interest only to specialists. The oldest of Rig Veda contains no mention of rebirth at all, according to Arthur, who was an expert in these things, and fluent in the Sanskrit language, so he can take his word for that. As far as I know, nobody's disputed it, probably because they're not that interested in finding out. They did find the first mention in the series of books that came later than the Vedas, more popular, perhaps, amongst people interested in India, called the Upanishads. And the oldest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, contains the first mention, the first articulated mention of the theory of reincarnation, or rebirth. And it occurs in a conversation between Yajnavalkya, this famous sage of days gone by a long time ago, and another chap called Atapaga, who had another name, but I can't remember it. It was probably Gupta or something like that. And what happens is Atapaga asks Yajnavalkya questions. It's a lot like the questions of King Milinda, actually. It makes me wonder a little bit that one is really a copy of the other. Anyway, one of the questions he asks him, it's a series of questions, is, well, what he does is he sets out the normal understanding of what happens to a person after death. And he talks about a man, of course, because in ancient India in those days, I'm afraid women didn't matter a lot. Just there to make the chapatis, etc. It's all been like that, ladies, I'm afraid. Changing a bit now. So he says, what happens to a man after death, Yanya? And then he explains the normal understanding, how the different parts of the organism, physical and mental, go back to the different elements of nature. Like your urine goes into the waters, the semen goes into the waters, and this, that, and the other goes here, there, and everywhere else. He says, okay, when all that's happened, everything has gone back to its original place, where is that man then? In other words, what's become of him? Where's he gone? Yajnavalkya refuses to answer at that moment because there are a crowd of people. He says, all right, I can give you an answer to this question, but not here, because it's knowledge that only I have. That's his words, according to the text that comes from the Upanishad. They go off somewhere and they have a conversation, and Yajnavalkya reveals the workings of karma, or as he puts it, karman. It's the ancient version of karma, the ancient word. That what you do in this life and previous lives causes you to winnow away into the future, to get born in this way, that way, or the other way. It doesn't quite put it as clearly as that, but you can take it that that's what he's saying. And this is about maybe 100 years before the Buddha was even born, apparently, or 200 years, depending on which date you approve of for the Buddha's birth. So it would mean that by the time the Buddha began teaching, that rebirth was already got quite a hold on the Hindu mind. Not immediately, because it was a secret teaching, and Yajnavalkya makes that clear when he says, only I know this, now you will know it. Only us two must know it. But of course it also finished up in an Upanishad, so somebody else knew it. And yes, Yajna put it in there, I don't think he did. There's also some doubt as to the veracity of this, whether it's really actually happened in this way or not. Difficult to know, it so long ago. But it's the only mention that Bhashyam could find in the ancient Indian texts, the ancient Hindu texts. Not in the Vedas, he didn't find anything much there. Apparently he didn't have this belief at all in Vedic times, 5,000, 4,000 years ago. Upanishads came sometime later, maybe 1,000 years after the Vedas were composed. Brings it nearer to the Buddha's time, 2,600, 700, 800 years before the Christian era. Who knows? In which case it would have, although it was a private teaching, it would have been kept for the people in the know, as these sophisticated things always are. They tend to filter down through the levels of society and become common knowledge. So that probably by the time that Siddhartha Gautama was born, this was the common understanding, that, you know, rebirth was a fact. It happened. And it's undoubtedly true that if you read the scriptures, you will find rebirth everywhere. But not if you read them in the Pali language. The only word you will find will be jati, which means birth. But when they're translated into the English tongue, and I assume into other languages, other Western languages, and they finish up meaning the same thing, rebirth, rather than simple birth. Curious. So great a need is it for us to somehow live in a happy, stable way, I say. It's become a habit amongst translators to do this. Even the best of them, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's translated all the Buddhist scriptures in recent times, all of them. It's a staunch rebirth man. The old Sri Lankan monks, the German monks, Nyanatiloka, Nyanamuri, his English, he was a bit different, but he too was a rebirth man. They've always been rebirth people. Doing precisely what the Buddha tells you not to do, just following on in the same old pattern. Because it's always been taught, set in stone, it's become dogma, I suppose. Buddhadasa was not having that. He wasn't having any of this. He knew there had to be something more to Buddhism than the usual superstitious business. All that candle lighting and chanting was all very well, that's what people wanted, but, you know, is this all the Buddha had to teach? Obviously not. I mean, there were scriptures, they just needed to be investigated, possibly translated and retranslated to some extent. He needed somebody who was willing to sit down and do the job properly. So just hanging around in the monastery and chanting every day and being well paid for it. That's what he did. He made himself slave of the Buddha. And he said a lot of very unwelcome things. Some samples we've given you already in this retreat. And here's another one. Said quite openly that the Buddha was not teaching rebirth after his investigations had proved that to him. This man was he wasn't just an intellectual, which is what I always thought he was. And lots of people, when they first meet his work, mainly because of what's being translated, tend to think that. The man had a very bright and clear mind. He did what he practiced, what he preached. And he was a monk, his character was unimpeachable. Which was a problem for people, because they didn't like what he had to say. It would have been nice if he hadn't been around, or could be disrobed or got rid of in some way, but that was not possible. And he didn't stop saying the things he was saying. Imagine what a brave you need to be in a country like this, entrenched in the sort of superstitious understanding of Buddhism, as it was and still is. Or it could be dangerous to say things like the Buddha was not teaching rebirth. It's dangerous enough anyway to set yourself up like that, go in the face of everything that's ever been taught and believed. And say it on the radio even, that he had, this is what he did. Because he knew he was right. He wouldn't have done it otherwise. What he never said was that rebirth didn't happen. But people don't listen. They get angry straight away. All they hear is no rebirth. In actual fact, he said the Buddha was not teaching it. And so lots of angry people arose very quickly, some of them very important and a little bit dangerous, but made no difference to Buddhadasa. He always stuck by his guns. And increasing number of people have come to see things in just the same way over the years. And his understanding, you don't need to worry about, for instance, how whatever it is, this stream of consciousness goes from one life to another, because there's another problem for the rebirthers to explain. You know, okay, alright, there's no me, and the desire that I feel throughout, during the course of my life, it builds up these things called defilements in the subconscious, and they force me to keep on living in the same way, and that just carries on at death, right? The body dies, so I won't look like this in the future, which is a nice idea. My consciousness just goes on. What I call my conscious, the conscious stream just goes on. Is that what you're saying? And that's the way it's generally taught. But then somebody might say, well, great, but, you know, how do I end up as a lion or something, or a tiger, or a dog, or in hell, or in heaven? How do I get from this body to another body? How does this stream of consciousness manage that? And this is where it all gets a bit sticky and strange. All sorts of things have to be invented to explain these awkward questions away. And that's, more than anything else, is what does not satisfy me at all. And Buddhadasa rendered this as rebirth of the ego sense, from moment to moment, or experience to experience, during the course of one human lifetime. And didn't bother to pay attention to what might happen after death, or what happened before birth. He was not interested in that. As far as he was concerned, it was something which was not sanditiko, that is, it could not be experienced personally. It was something you had to take on trust. As far as he was concerned, as a teaching, rebirth in the physical sense from life to life was useful. It suited certain people, and that's what they should be taught. Until they came to knowledge of a different kind in their own time, at their own steam. Then perhaps they could deal with things that perhaps went against their belief. And this obviously came from bitter experience of having said the Buddha was not teaching rebirth. And so he did eventually admit that there was some use to the social teaching of rebirth. It had a social use. Days gone by, religion was, I suppose, mainly used in that way. The promise of heaven or hell after death, keep you under control as a human being, keep you toeing the line, which in a social system you need. You need something greater than law. You need something beyond the law to do this. And now they have something else called consumerism, does it quite well. Everybody wants to be part of that deal, so they play the game. They're all good little consumers, I suppose, including me. I got a computer, that makes me a consumer. But somebody gave it to me, so I'm not really a consumer. I haven't eaten a Mars bar for 20 years. I haven't smoked for 30. I haven't done anything interesting for a long time. Anyway, what Buddhadasa did was he rejigged the idea of rebirth into the, if you want to use the term rebirth, which he was willing, he was okay with, as long as you understood it as happening from experience to experience, and provoked by experience too. If you experience something you find stimulating, that is, you perceive stimulation in something, or even depression, but the Buddha never talks about depression when he explains this kind of thing. It's always stimulation. So let's stick with that. You experience something that you perceive as having some meaning for you, which will excite or stimulate, then it's the experience. As the mind processes and responds to the experience, then it causes the feeling of me to arise with the experience. Or a little bit later than the experience, doesn't really matter. It's a reaction to experience, the feeling of self. But it's only a reaction to the sort of experience which is abnormal. That is, we have a desire for something we don't need, but which we know is going to bring us some excitement, and stir us up, and make life a little more what we call sublime, more exciting. If we could just be human beings and stay where we are, doing what we're doing at the moment, we'd be quite happy to do that, picking berries up bushes or whatever, without always wanting to be doing something else, going somewhere else, we wouldn't have this problem. And we can't. And so it's the experiences that we prefer to experience, the things we want because they stimulate us rather than the things we need to keep us alive. Anything abnormal creates an abnormal mental response. Everything about the mental response is abnormal. And what it produces is something abnormal. mental suffering, as the Buddhists call it, dukkha, and the me who experiences it. It's an aberration, not a reality. The process is fairly straightforward. You don't even need to go into details. Any desire you have for something you don't need, anything you let the mind fix on so that it causes you to acquire the thing you desire, is that very process of acquisition, thinking about something and then going and getting it, it will also create the you who's going to experience the thing that you want. You will be born mentally as me to experience whatever it is you desire. The desirer is born from the desire for the experience. This is the way Buddhadasa looked at it, and this is the way the Buddhist scriptures look at it, the truth be told. But, as mentioned, it's sometimes difficult to separate the two in the Buddha's teaching. And this is the way Buddhadasa understood rebirth. So if you want to see a movie, then everything you do, once you let the mind stick to the idea of a certain movie, think of a film, anything you like. I like old films, still like films. And the older, the better. I like 1940s, 50s films, usually. But if you go back beyond that, it gets a bit kind of strange, because the trends and fashions of the 1930s look really very odd to me. Yeah, the 40s, that's a slightly modern appearance. It's a reasonably settled time in the human situation on this planet, I think, 1940s, despite the fact he fought a couple of big wars around that time. The 1950s. A movie from that time, you want to see. It's on the television tonight, you see it on a movie channel, whatever it is they call it. And that's okay, it's an old film, it's the sort of thing you like. You see it in the, whatever it is that tells you it's on the television, a newspaper or whatever. Ah, that, I'd like to see that. So your mind immediately kind of takes hold of it. But before the mind clings or takes hold of the idea of seeing that film, it will have processed it to some extent. The eye will have seen the advertisement, and that will have given rise to a consciousness. And then a feeling will have arisen as a result of that. Just like listening to the bell in the morning, being woken up by the bell. And in this case, it's the eye that will receive the visible object, the advertisement in the paper. But you won't know anything much about what you're experiencing until perception tells you what's going on. So first the eye will see, and then consciousness will arise, and then the mind will get involved. Then a feeling will follow on from that, a neutral feeling. And then perception will arise to recognize what it is you're looking at. And as soon as you recognize, as soon as perception recognizes, then something else will happen. The defilements will enter the experience because it recognizes this movie. And it's a movie you know about and you'd like to see. And here it is, it's on the television tonight. Once the defilements enter, then this is the beginning of the problem. Basically, when the defilements enter the mind, they're really bringing selfishness with them in an abnormal way. The mind is going to change. It's going to become what they call subjective. And it's this subjective sense, which is that as you experience the experience, as desire increases and you do the things to get the experience, is that the defilements themselves representing the subjective sense will expand into the full sense of me. It's like blowing up a balloon. Mm-hmm. Every time you experience this happens. Now basically that's it. Once the defilements blow up into the full sense of ego, then there's a you experiencing the thing of your desire, the movie. So you might have to go to the cinema to see this film. So first you see it in the newspaper, and as mentioned, your eye receives the image, feeling arises as a result of that, consciousness arises, and a feeling arises. The feeling is neutral in the beginning, because you don't know what you're looking at. You're just scanning the page. And although you read the advertisement, as you read it, so perception deciphers what it says and you then recognize what it means. This all happens very quickly. And then things change. Then the feeling you experience is no longer a simple, true Vedana. It becomes a feeling of delight, excitement. Ah! The thing from another world. The thing from, you ever thought about that? The thing from another world. The willy from another world. Imagine that. It was made about 1950, it was black and white, but there was a colour version of it made And I must admit, I managed to acquire that. It's a kind of collector's item. It's one of those movies which was really very good, scary for its time, but the acting and the dialogue is superb. Best I've ever seen, ever come across in a film. Even Double Indemnity can't match it. Perfect. Very well directed, too. So I think from another world, you've seen it, and the recognition has taken place. So being technical and being a little detailed, what's happened then is the defilements enter the levels, enter the conscious level of the mind, and now they start to change the experience. They charge it up, as it were, they make it larger than life. Everything you experience, everything that happens from this point on, is mixed with defilement, with ignorance, basically. So you're not experiencing reality anymore. What those defilements bring with them primarily is this little subjective twinge to the mind. The mind is not subjective in its true state. And the Buddhists say, remember, the mind disappears at the end of any experience. This kind of arises brand new for the next experience. So it's pure. It's untroubled. Perfect. The only thing wrong with it, it doesn't have knowledge. It's ignorant, but not in the sense that we normally think of being ignorant. It just doesn't have knowledge of deliverance. The way to be delivered from the problems of life. It doesn't have knowledge of its own true nature. But in another sense, it's pure. It's pure until the defilements enter, and they only enter once the mind functions as far as perception. The first pass of perception will reveal something about what's being experienced which is meaningful, then the defilements will come. And you can think of greed, aversion, and delusions more or less representing the beginnings of the ego sense. They come up from the subconscious into the conscious levels. And then as you pay attention to the experience, read the advertisement, and then look for, there's even a review of the film, what it's about. This is a good movie, it says so, so it must be right. It's all about this big monster, this vegetable, that eats things and all sorts of nasty things. Actually, the story is very clever. But the film, when they made it in 1950, they couldn't manage the special effects necessary. Because it's about a creature that crash lands on the Earth thousands of years ago, and they discover it in the Antarctic in this spaceship. And this thing is very strange. It can absorb whatever it comes into contact with and duplicate them precisely. This is how it survives. So this film is all about how it does, or the book is all about that. But of course they couldn't do that in the 1950s. So they made it a little different. It's a big vegetable, a big walking carrot going, and doing nasty things to dogs mainly. I mean, not sexually perverted things, but nasty things. The big carrot is played by James Arness, which is about as good as he ever did as an actor. He was the carrot in Thing from Another World, in The Willy from Another World. So that's the movie, and then as you read this, you know, well, you know the story already, but, you know, And there's a nice picture. Because you also have a picture of a lady, blonde, very curvaceous, because this is Hollywood in the 1950s. The feminine ideal was just to look like that. And she's not naked, because she didn't have those things in those days, but scantily dressed in the arms of the hero, and this big green thing is stalking up on them, and this guy has just saved this woman from a fate worse than death. If you see what I mean. So there's the film, and you see that, and you're getting excited, and the very excitement that you're experiencing and desire to see the film is making that little tinge of subjectivity that comes with the defilements expand and grow until eventually it becomes full and complete. And the way that happens is really because of the desire you feel to see the film and the things you then do to get to see the film. Desire is strange. It always, if you desire something in a foolish way over a period of time, the desire turns into something called clinging. The mind sticks to things. Like this movie, you won't be able to forget it. Your mind will stick to it. You just keep coming back. You have to see it. Drive yourself crazy thinking about it otherwise. And that's called clinging. The Pali word is upadana. The desire you'll feel will be called tanha. There's different kinds of desire. There's wise desire, there's unwise desire. But human beings lacking knowledge always desire in an unwise way, say the Buddhists. So our desire is always tanha. And this is precisely what creates the ego sense, what starts the ego sense really expanding in the mind. The thing to get, though, at the beginning of this experience, when you're just reading the newspaper idly, you know, might have been bored, nothing else to do, just glancing through it, see if there's anything you missed. And you happen to have missed this page, maybe pages were stuck together or something. And now you are. You see the advert, you see the television stuff, and there it is, Think from Another World. The mind is pure at the moment that you first see that. There's no sense of self involved, there's no, there's nothing going on. The mind is basically ignorant, it lacks knowledge. That's all. And so the subconscious defilements can enter just like that, because there's no knowledge, there's no mindfulness, there's no practice going on. And so you just, mind opens up, as it always does when it experiences things, and in come the defilements, in comes the advertisement, as it were, the concept, or what's on the printed page enters the mind to be deciphered. The defilements will enter too. But only one's perception recognizes, not other thing from another world straight away, the defilements enter. And the subjective sense comes with them. Remember, it's not there at the beginning of the experience. We think there's always a me living life, but really there isn't, say the Buddhists. And this is how it arises. Anytime you let yourself get excited, this is what happens. The mind is pure, and then it's not. And the impurity is basically the you, growing up, is going to grow in dependence on the experience that causes you to get excited. So when you see the advert, this is what happens. The more excited, the more you read, the more you get into it, then the mind desires to increase the excitement, because it's a pleasant thing to be excited. Beyond a certain point, the mind will cling to the object. It will cling to the idea of the film. And from that point on, you won't really be able to stop yourself from going to see it, because it's in the front room, it's in the sitting room on the television, so you haven't got to go far. All you have to do is wait for the time to arrive. So it might be a little edgy because of that. What time is it? Gosh. Another hour, yeah? I've got to kill another hour. What can I do? Well, have another beer, I suppose. Watch a football match. That's right, yeah. Do that. Being wise human beings, this is what we do. We'll forget what happens when you watch the football match, because that would spoil it. And eventually, when the time comes to go switch the TV on, you've got your six-pack, your cheeseburgers, everything is there. Got the wife locked upstairs out of the way. She can't be a nuisance. She wants to watch some female thing, but you're not into that. You want to see the thing from another world. And you don't want her around, because you've seen the picture of the blonde lady. She might be in it. Oh, can lust after the blonde lady. You can't do that if your wife's there. Well, I suppose you could. It wouldn't be very nice. Besides, you might lust after the hero of the film. Or the monster, the six-foot carrot. Anyway, the time arrives, you plonk yourself down, you reach forward, you turn the TV on, because in these days you used to turn things on, you didn't have a machine that did it. You know, you had to. Jesus. When are they going to invent? Life was hard in those days. You turn the television on and off, and there it is. Dun, dun, da-dun, dun, da-dun, that kind of music it is. RKO. Remember it well. And the world spinning in the middle. You can see the piece of metal holding it up. And an aeroplane going round it or something, some ancient thing. This is the way it used to be. And then the thing comes up, the thing from another world. Titles come up. And then the film starts. And it starts in the Antarctic, you know. American base in the Antarctic. That's where the whole story begins in this movie. The minute it starts, then all that you've done prior to that, once you saw the film, once you began the desire to increase the stimulating feeling coming from having seen that it's on the television, once you let the mind cling therefore to seeing it, then all that, then all you did after that, prepare things to acquire the movie, that is to get everything ready to sit down, to turn the television on, all that is what causes the feeling of me to grow up from that inflow, that entry of the defilement at the beginning of the experience is expanded into the me who watches the film, the feeling of me. Because the self is only a feeling. It's not like a great real physical thing enters the room and replaces you. It's just a feeling in the mind. And this is how it works. When you think about it, it's not that difficult to understand, is it? You have a desire, and if you let the mind cling to the thing you have a desire for, and if you think too much about it, you can't stop thinking about it, this will happen. The you then will grow up in the mind, and then you'll have to do something about the thing that you're experiencing. You'll have to get it in some way, or acquire it, or watch it, or listen to it, or whatever. And the moment you do that, you could say, to keep it very simple, that you will be born fully as the me who's experiencing that experience. So the me who watches the film is born from the desire to see the movie. The interesting part is that the mind is pure at the beginning of this experience. It doesn't have knowledge, but it's basically pure. There's nothing there but the mind. There's no me involved. And then once the defilements enter, once perception recognizes meaning, once the scanner of perception recognizes some meaning in the experience which might stimulate, then that's when the feeling of self will begin to arise, because that's when the defilements will come from the subconscious into the conscious levels. And that's when there will be a sense of subjectivity, which will gradually increase into a very strong sense of subjectivity we call me. And this will happen over and over, not just once. In the course of a day, if you seek these kind of experiences, it doesn't matter what they are, you know. I mean, a movie like this is quite a stimulating thing. But you could drink a cup of coffee, or a can of Coca-Cola, because these things are unnecessary for life. It's an abnormal desire for something that stimulates. Otherwise you just drink water. But we don't do that, do we? We want to eat something. Well, there will be something you like, and in the modern world, something full of artificial flavors, probably, which actually looks good in the packet, etc. All our experiences tend to be of this sort. This is what we want. And these precisely are the experiences that first of all allow the defilements to enter the mind, and then to grow up into the me who experiences the experience. And once there's a you, once you're born, as they say, mentally, once you've been jatied, which means birth, then you have to experience that. There's a you who's alive and kicking. It's not just the mind and body experiencing life anymore, it's you. We don't know this, usually, because we're not interested enough to find it out, and B, nobody tells us. And see, well, we never think it was this way anyway. We think there's always a me living life. And you see, the Buddhists right at the beginning deny that. And atta, what is here is not you. And they're telling you how the illusion arises and how it's sustained. It's sustained by these kind of experiences. The more of them you seek, the more times you allow yourself to be stimulated, the more senses of self that will give rise to. The little baby does it very early in its life. Probably from the feeding process and from the other stuff that goes on while it's being fed, etc. It does it increasingly as it grows up, because it can move around, it can experience things in a more advanced way as it grows. It can crawl and then it can walk. It walk around the furniture first of all, they hold the furniture. They haven't got far to fall, and you sit on that bum, look very surprised, have good laugh after. Climb back up, start walking around the furniture again. But eventually they learn to wobble outside into the garden, and then the house next door. They've got that to experience. The garden is a place perhaps they've only been in the pushchair or pram, or in the cart or something. Now they're taken out into the garden or just wobble out there themselves and look around, sit in the dirt making little patterns. Sometimes children will do this. We'll find many more things then to delight in. And every time it does it, and its mind will do precisely what we've just said, but in a very childish way. Those defilements, remember, they start with this kind of experience. The child, when it's very small, begins to create those root defilements, greed, aversion, and delusion. And every time it experiences them, if it's sort of experience that can create, that can cause it to happen, then those defilements will enter that child's mind, and it will go on experiencing in the same way. It will create a habitual response to life. And we always seek stimulation in this experience is beyond a certain age. And beyond a certain age, probably quite young, it will fall into believing that this is me, because it will have this feeling of me enter its mind so often, as it experiences more often, then this will become very solidly set in its mind, a kind of strong habit pattern, which is very difficult to break. And eventually, in It might be the you who's watching the film. We've all gone the same way. According to this understanding, I was the same when I was small. I had the same childish desires. I created the same childish ego senses in just the same way. I've got the same underlying patterns, the defilement. The only difference between me and most people is that I can control them to some extent. I know they're there, I know how they work. I'm not a fool, I spend a lot of time dealing with this stuff. But I see it very clearly. It happens in the way that the Buddha explains. This is the Buddha's words now, not just Buddhadasana. He explains this in language which can be misunderstood, or can be understood in two ways. You can look at it as explaining physical rebirth, or you can understand it as explaining the rebirth of the ego sense into the mind during the course of one life. If you want to drink a cup of coffee, you have to think about it first. The mind has to recognize some meaning. Perception has to pick some meaning up from coffee, from Nescafe, from 3-in-1, or whatever it is you like to drink. And then you'll start to act to get that, because the feeling will be stimulating feelings. Even a small thing like a cup of coffee is abnormal, it produces an abnormal feeling. Either disgust or stimulation. Disgust is Nescafe. And when you make the coffee, what do? You open the sachet, put it in the cup, go to the water boiler. You pump the water in. Everybody can hear you. So you do it quietly. If you're not. Naughty, naughty. You say, there, another cup of coffee there. That's about 10, you say. Caught yourself a monk, he's not as good as me. I only drink Ovaltine. When you do that, you see, and then you get the coffee and you sit down and down it goes. The you's been born who drinks the coffee from the experience. Then it will last just as long as the experience lasts, like the baby. It will fade away and leave the mind. It will disappear with the experience, as will the self-sense. And then the next fine thing that you come across, that you get involved with, if it's of the same kind, will create a new sense of self. Just as it will create a new mind. It creates a mind, it creates a mind state, and the sense of self is no more than a state of mind. Which will last just as long as the experience lasts. So the Buddha says this is what really happens. It's always coming and going like this. You just don't know it, you think it's always around. So we always have problems because of that, of course. Once you realize it's not, once you begin to think, maybe this is right, then you can test it just by keeping your mind under control. And so you return once more to the food reflection. There are four of those reflections, by the way, not just food, but clothing, shelter, medicines, four requisites of life as part of the monastic training. To learn to use these things wisely. One of the first things you learn when you enter the monkhood is this. It's a chant. Manchester United, so on and so forth. That's what it's saying. It's telling you how to approach food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. Not for excitement, not for stimulation, but merely to sustain the body and to, in a monk's case or nun's case, to pursue the brahmacharya, the holy life. That's all it's for. Basically, for any of us, if we want to be, get our minds to be really clear, then we need to do something about the ego sense. And once you understand how it arises, you don't have to take anybody's word for this, because you can test it. Just deny yourself the usual stimulation for a few days, or half a day, or even one day, and see how you feel. See if your mind doesn't slow down and become much quieter. Because you won't be stimulating. You won't be concocting, as they say. The Phung Teng will not be happening. Phung Teng is the Thai word for concocting. Gan Phung Teng. All sounds like Phung Teng to me. Gan Phung Teng. You see, you can't test it. You can't really do that with rebirth. You have to believe that you're going to be reborn into a new existence after death. For this kind of rebirth, you can test any time you want. You don't even need that much of a mental, of a quiet mind to do it. It's obvious. Once you learn to spot the qualities the self-sense brings with it, basically confusion of mind. If But to recognize that, you need to have a nice peaceful mind at some time, so you can compare the two. It's really just an excitement entering the mind, which the mind then identifies itself as the me's experiencing. But we get a little complicated if we start to go into those kind of areas. Best to keep it simple. It's just like defilement entering, seeping into the mind. A little stream of defilement finds its way into the conscious area of the mind and then becomes a big raging torrent in dependence on the experience, being experienced. Eventually becomes the ego sense, the me who experiences, and the me who has to experience aging, sickness and death, for instance. Because once you're born, whether you're born physically or mentally, you're going to experience aging, sickness and death. Everybody does. That's not a problem. But if you experience them in such a way that they become frightening, or worrying, or anxiety-making, that's what happens with us. Death is not a problem, but it is for ignorant human beings, because it's my death and it frightens me. I don't want to know about that. My mother's death, my father's death, oh no, thank you. That's what happens. That's where the dukkha comes from. The fear of these things, which is just concepts. The fear of disease, the fear of sickness, cancer, AIDS. Some forms of cancer are very frightening for people. So on and so forth. There are many other diseases that can be extremely unpleasant. Fear of the aging process, of ending up like me in all conjure, but you will. I promise you. If you live that long, you'll go just the same way. And you might not look so good as I do. At least I do if I don't put my glasses on when I look at myself. Still got my teeth, mostly, except for these plastic ones in front. They're not plastic, they're Ming Dynasty porcelain. I should be so lucky. See, that's the problem. When you're born, you must experience dukkha because you must experience life. And there's an obvious form of dukkha. You get the stimulation of the film, but it comes to an end. So you're watching the clock, see how much more you've got of this delightful experience left. Oh, another hour yet before it finishes. Great. But eventually it is going to finish. Then you get depressed. Your mind's been up, now it goes down. Now it experiences dukkha instead of sukha. And we spend our life doing this, always going up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. Always anxious, always fearful, always worried. Never able to stay still and quiet in the present, experiencing life as it happens because of that. We're always running away from this, that and the other. Always looking for something different to stimulate ourselves with. The whole process is sometimes referred to as coming into existence. It's the coming into existence of the self-sense. It's something we do all the time. You can never just be what we are. We have to be something else, somewhere else. We're always chasing existences. Being born this way, mentally. Being born that way, mentally. You can stop it by guarding the sense doors, as they call it, but you can't really guard the sense doors until you're extremely skillful. You can stop the defilements from entering the mind if you can be aware enough to pick up the first moment of any sense experience and the feeling is still basically neutral. Whether that's actually possible, I don't know. Most people will never be able to do that, but what you can do is recognize the mind beginning to respond foolishly to a desire of a certain kind because the experience is stimulating. All you do then is simply observe the process that's happening. If you're eating food, just start observing the food, so the enjoyment is a thing of the past. You're not eating it to be enjoyed, you're eating it to observe it, to observe the process of eating. Just the same way you meditate on the breathing. You could do it with a movie or music. This is why music can be used as a meditation object. Even movies can be meditated on, providing you don't let the mind get caught by the film. You don't let the mind cling. Because then it gets into the film as an exciting thing. But if you just sit there and observe the movie and keep your mind still, you can do it to a certain extent. The movies are very different. You see them in a very different way. Anything can be experienced in this way. It's difficult. You have to change your lifestyle. That's why the Buddhists have precepts, the Christians have the Ten Commandments, etc., etc. It's difficult because we don't live in a way to make it easy. But if you're willing to follow the precepts, keep yourself under control, practice meditation, develop your ability to be mindful, you can quickly realize that the self is an illusion. You can't get rid of it so quickly, but you see how it changes when you don't feed it. It's like you have an animal in your head. and it feeds on sense experience of a stimulating kind. If you keep on giving it stimulating food, then it's going to keep on getting bigger and stronger. But if you don't do that, you try and live sensibly, try and get yourself under control. Keep yourself away from the things that stimulate, then this creature will begin to lose strength and power very quickly indeed. And in some cases, maybe one day, half a day of living very carefully can make a big difference. You can do it for a week. It could make all the difference in the world to you as a human being. It can be that quick. But how easy is it to do that? Because it means giving up all the things that we live for. All the things that excite, stimulate. These are what we live for. People don't come to Thailand to sit meditation. Some do. It's pretty damn weird, but they do. I didn't come here to sit meditation. Came here not by accident, but I had nowhere else to go. I still had some cash left, so I thought I'd been there before. It wasn't much of a place, but it'll do. So I got the flight from Calcutta, the old $60 flight. I can get that now. Came into Dongmen with a skid landing, Indian Airways, and came up into Thailand. Very different from Calcutta when you come out to Dongmen. You don't do that now, you come into the other airport, I expect. But that's why I traveled. I didn't travel because I was looking to, you know, become a big meditator or an enlightened being. I traveled because I liked to be stimulated. England wasn't stimulated. I knew places that would be, like India, for instance, which was immediately my favorite. So I went there, but on the way I wandered down through Europe, because I'd like to take my time over these things. I bought some insurance, which lasted for 6 months. It was when I was in India, so I wasn't thinking very clearly at all. By the time I got to India, the insurance had run out by about 6 months. All that money was completely wasted. I never got sick anyway, not in a serious way. But everything I've ever done has been the seeking of stimulation. It's nice not to do it, you know, and to recognize the difference that comes, and to feel that the self-sense fade away to some extent. I'm not the egotist I used to be. Okay, I still have one, but it's a little thing now. It used to be a monumental one, 6 foot carrot. It was a terrible thing. I knew everything. It was the greatest thing you'd ever seen. A delusion. Human beings can do this. Now I know what I am, just a funny little Englishman with certain talents which are pretty very mediocre. It doesn't bother me at all. I'm quite happy to be like that. I have to be what I am and watch life come and go and be careful in the way I live it in as much as I'm able to do that. I can promise you the rewards are great. What you get is a peaceful life. But that's not what people want usually, is it? Meditation's useful. It can introduce you to this anyway. If the experience is strong enough, that in itself can cause you to make radical changes to the way you live. But you see, you can control this business we just described. And it's always happening to us if we allow it to. You can control it. You simply remember the words of the food reflection, apply them to whatever experience you're undergoing. Remember not to let your mind get stirred up. And all you need to do to stop that happening is simply observe the experience you're involved in. In walking meditation is much like breathing meditation, so you use the movement of the feet. You can do it when you go to the toilet. You can observe the process of going to the toilet. Why not? It's a natural thing. When you take a wee-wee, you can do the same thing. I do this all the time. Exciting it is. See how high the wall I can get it. That's what I used to do. I don't do it anymore. Monks don't do things like that. Anything at all you can apply this kind of knowledge to. And if you're willing to practice and develop your mindfulness, then in no long time your life can be very different. Anyway, this is all we have time for. We've looked at the practice of anapanasati in some detail. Remember, the main point of that really is, okay, it's to reproduce what happened to the Buddha, but it also is to develop mindfulness. For most of us, this should be the main aim. If we have mindfulness which is good enough, which means fast enough, then we don't need to think too much about concentration, because we'll have that too. And then we have a look at the Buddha's teaching. We've looked at the elements of Buddhism, and today we've pieced it all together, explained how the ego sense arises. And it's really not a difficult thing to understand. And how that process can be controlled if you feel inclined to do it. You can get quite a lot from coming to a retreat like this. You can thank Buddhadasa for most of it. Don't forget that. I might be a nice guy, at least on the surface. I speak nicely, because I was trained to speak to some extent. And I'm not a fool. I recognize something of quality when I meet it, and Buddhadasa's style of teaching Buddhism to me is the best thing I've ever come across in this field. Have a nice day.